Welcome to episode 178 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real, who matters, and how we can make a better world. The Sentientism worldview answers those deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Kendra Coulter. Kendra is a professor at Huron University and a fellow of the Oxford Centre for Animal Ethics. She's a leading expert on animals and work, animal protection organisations and policy, and gender equity. Kendra has led multiple research projects enriching our understanding of human-animal work and animals' own forms of labour in important new directions, including through development of the concept of humane jobs, interspecies solidarity, and eco-social reproduction. Dr. Kendra's latest book is Defending Animals, Finding Hope on the Front Lines of Animal Protection. She's the author of dozens of scholarly articles, book chapters and reports, and has also published more than 60 columns in a wide range of public newspapers and magazines. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 177 others in our timeless back catalogue. Why not let me know via review or rating? Reviews, ratings and sharing really help more people find out about the Sentientism worldview, hopefully nudging the world towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for Sentientism, that's sentient with ism on the end, on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening.
But I thought that their lives deserved more, that the stories of who they were, their subjectivity, who they truly were, was not properly being captured in those charts and graphs. And that to me is crucial if you're seeking to work across species, is that animals don't need to be like us, or we don't need to be like them for us to know that they matter. And I think we need to acknowledge the horror, be clear about what we've done to the planet, what we've done to each other, what we've done to animals. But along with horror, hope coexists. And solidarity is a feeling, but it can't remain internalized. It too is a fusion of reason and emotion, which invites and challenges us to act. Expansion of the plant-based foods, investments in lab-grown meat and dairy in ways that cause almost no violence to animals. These strategies are extremely important. We're replacing harm. We're creating new humane jobs. We're making investments that are changing the products that people consume, from fashion to cosmetics to food. This is a really significant time in terms of possibility.
Good morning, Kendra. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, great. It's brilliant to have the chance to talk to you. You've been on my guest list, wish list, for a while. And there was an additional prompt because your new book, Defending Animals, has some wonderful blurbs on it, including three of my previous guests from Zaya Tong and Jeff Sebo and Mark Beckoff. So my eye was immediately drawn to it, and I thought it would be the perfect chance to bring you on and add you to the guest list. That's brilliant to get the chance to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Likewise, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. It's a wonderful opportunity.
So we've talked briefly before, and I think you're roughly familiar with what I'm trying to do here, but I guess this series of conversations is focused on what I think of as the deepest philosophical questions, the question of what's real and how should we go about understanding reality, but just as important, what and who matters ethically. And I have an obvious bias in answering those two questions because I'm trying to popularize and develop this very simple pluralistic worldview called sentientism, which in a sentence is evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. So when it comes to that epistemological question, it says, well, let's use evidence and reason to try and engage honestly with reality, to try and work out what the hell is going on and what is true and what isn't. And when it comes to the ethical question, the clue is in the name, we should have compassion and moral consideration for every sentient being. But I'm talking to dazzling variety of different people in these conversations. Some of them agree with sentientism, many of them don't. So it'd be fascinating to understand your own philosophical journey and how that influences and drives your work, and particularly your new book. But before we get into those big questions, how would you best introduce yourself for people who don't know you already?
Well, my name is Kendra Coulter, but I'm not related to Ann Coulter, who might be known to a British or global audience. I want to make that perfectly clear. We have slightly different worldviews, you could say. I'm officially a professor of management and organizational studies at Western University's Huron University College in Canada, a fellow of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics, and some other sort of titles of that nature. But I think at the core, maybe the most important way for me to articulate this is that I think the primary purpose of my life is to improve and save animals' lives. So that's very much central to my personal existence, my professional work, and the intersections between the two. So in as many ways as possible, I seek to use my voice or my platform as a microphone or an amplifier for the voices of others. I seek to offer my unique analytical skills and ideally nuanced analysis, understanding these issues and cultivating empathy, compassion for living beings very much like yours. I fit quite comfortably in the approach that you're promoting. The ending a word with ism is a bit interesting, because on the one hand we have discriminatory isms, and then we have sort of proactive or agitational or generative isms, and I certainly think that foregrounding sentient beings is a very powerful mobilizing way of thinking about the positives and trying to find unity and common cause.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess that was part of the motivation behind co-opting this term, thinking about a sort of justice movement, if you like, or at least a worldview around this idea, is that it is a positive response to a lot of those negative isms. You know, one of the most important things we can do is reject the negative isms, right? And there are important movements doing that. But I just have this feeling that just rejecting the negative isms isn't quite enough. We also want some sort of positive stance about what we do care about and what we should care about and who should matter. So I guess that's part of the motivation behind it. Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely. That's been central to my entire academic career, is that we need to critique the problems, undoubtedly. We also simultaneously need to be developing and proposing alternatives and solutions. So I think that's a really powerful and essential way of framing our work.
Yeah. Although, as you say, your job title is as an academic at an academic institution, you're not one of those ivory tower people either. I mean, the breadth of your writing and the impact of your writing, I think you've been published pretty much everywhere, as far as I can tell, is really impressive. And this new book, you know, continues that pattern. So yeah, thank you for that. So it's prefigured quite a lot of the themes I think we'll cover as we go through these questions. So let's start with the first of those big questions, the question of what's real and how do we understand the reality that we all share. And this question of what's real and epistemology is very broad. It can cover all sorts of different things about what and how we believe and what are the best ways of going about believing. But for many of my guests, a good place to start is how they grew up originally and whether that was in family or a social context that was maybe more religious or spiritual or supernaturally inspired in some way, or one that was maybe more scientifically minded or naturalistic or atheistic or a mix of the two or something different, and how that side of their thinking changed over their life. So yeah, you can wind the clock back as far as you like to, you know, tell that story about how you think about the best way of understanding reality.
Well, we can wind it back to me being on the back of a horse before I could walk and learning out about how to be kind to animals on what was our farm at that time, learning how to touch and pat dogs with respect as well. More intellectually, I was raised by atheists, by left-wing people. And so to this day, I maintain a very progressive worldview. However, I would say I've become less ideological. I think it's absolutely crucial to have an ethical core and an ethical engine, but that the process of inquiry, the process of evidence gathering and analysis, having data, is absolutely essential. So for me, that translates into a few things, into dialogue with different groups or individuals who might have slightly different views. Obviously, there are limits within that, especially in this world of rising extremism. I think it's crucial to try to find connections while simultaneously recognizing that certain worldviews are antithetical to justice and equity for humans and other beings alike. But simultaneously, that translates to me believing in the importance of research, and including field research, which is talking, listening, watching. Sometimes it means smelling, experiencing things with your body in the context of animal cruelty investigations. And that I think it's absolutely crucial to be out engaging with real efforts, not sort of reclining into the ivory tower, as you noted, but rather engaging and communicating with broad cross-section of audiences, especially people on the front lines of the work that I'm studying, and that it's a dialogue, it's that I'm listening and taking and analyzing and understanding, but then simultaneously seeking to amplify and communicate with broader audiences. So I think that's an absolutely crucial and central part of my work, in a publicly funded university. I think public intellectual is one of the best compliments you can give someone, is that you believe that your ideas matter and that we need to be using ideas to inspire action. So very much finding those opportunities and always keeping that ethical core in mind, but being open to changing your mind or to softening or nuancing your position somewhat based on evidence and data. I think that's absolutely crucial. But never losing those core commitments. So, you know, I'm driven by a fundamental commitment to equity, to solidarity, and to justice.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. So it feels like even from the early days, there was a very sort of visceral sense of evidence, you know, engaging with the world, with the animals around you and using that. But then also that's been formalized to research and scientific exploits and so on, which makes it a little sharper and a bit more formal. But there's also this rich sense of engagement and dialogue and an ethical core as well. And it sometimes feels as if we're presented with this slightly bizarre choice between a sort of, you know, you can either be emotional and ethical or you can be scientific and rational. And that's just such a bizarre choice to be offered. When clearly, you know, we need a combination of the two. We need to understand reality ideally as it is, and that will always be flawed. But we need to give a shit, right? We need to care. Otherwise, what's the point of even understanding reality?
So you have said that brilliantly. Absolutely. It's not an either or.
No. And so would you just, and it's interesting that you were brought up with atheist parents. That's pretty rare at the moment. I think it's getting more common, but it's still reasonably rare. Would you still describe yourself as an atheist now, or have you sort of explored different aspects of religiosity or spirituality, you know, as you've grown up and developed and found your own way? Or?
In general, yes. You know, I mean, truthfully, I try to consciously avoid some of the big debates around death and afterlife and things that are often what inspire people to think about religion and spirituality. That said, I have seen more often than not the opportunity for people of a diversity of religious backgrounds to still identify opportunities for compassion for animals.
Yes, absolutely.
And when I'm thinking about someone like Andrew Lindsay, for example, who's working in a Christian tradition, and Claire Lindsay, I'm thinking about people like Margaret Robinson at Dalhousie University in Canada, who's working with Indigenous cosmologies. The spiritual breadth of the world in many ways is yet another opportunity for people to find compassion and empathy towards animals. So regardless of my particular religious views, which have not been central to my work, I think that it's encouraging that people around the world from different cultures, from different religious and spiritual approaches, still are able to recognize the importance of caring for others and caring for other sentient beings. And that, to me, is a great source of hope.
Yeah, absolutely. And probably one of the richest conversations I had on that topic was with Dr. Lisa Kemmerer. She's done really rich, deep research into exactly that idea of, you know, as you look at each of the different religious worldviews, Abrahamic and some of the Eastern ones, within, and her view is within absolutely every one, there is at least a seed and often much more than that, that you can use to justify and support and have a very rich sentiocentric compassion for human animals and non-human animals alike. And we had an interesting discussion because my sort of hypothesis was that maybe a naturalistic way of, you know, naturalistic epistemology is a better route to a sentiocentric compassion, because at least you don't have the sort of inbuilt hierarchy or the anthropocentrism or the, you know, the supernatural justifications for harming non-human animals that can sometimes exist in religious worldviews. So I sort of prefer a naturalistic route, but she was pushing back pretty hard. And we're saying, well, no, actually, there are really strong things to work with within every religious worldview. I mean, the idea of ahimsa is one of the most obvious. And so she actually has much more hope that, you know, religious communities might actually move faster towards a practical care and a rich care for non-human animals than, you know, than us naturalists and atheists. So, yeah, I agree. I think
One thing I would say is even on the naturalistic epistemology, the idea of using evidence and reason to ground beliefs is not some sort of Eurocentric Western thing, right? There's evidence and reasoning going on in almost every human culture around the world to varying degrees, and has been, you know, long before religions were even invented. It's not a modern invention to engage with reality to try and understand it. And I'd argue that even non-human animals did it for millions of years before we came on the scene, and they still do it now. I'm not suggesting they have a formal epistemology, but that's what they're doing, right? They're using their senses, trying to understand the world so they can survive and flourish. But almost regardless of what our epistemology is, we can still find rich common ground on compassion and ethics. So I agree.
Absolutely. And, that's, I think, the key focus is where can we find common ground? And more importantly, where can we work together to make positive change?
Yeah, exactly. And I think we can, at the same time, we can still be quite robust at pointing out areas where if people do have a supernatural or a spiritual or religious worldview that motivates them or they think justifies them in needlessly causing harm to others, I think we can be pretty sharp and pretty clear at pushing back on that. But positively, there's, you know, enormous rich overlap. You know, it's, in a sense, I'm not too worried about what your motivation for compassion and moral consideration is. If you have it, you know, we're allies and we can work together on that. So yeah, there's much hope.
Absolutely. If the goal is to improve and save lives, and reduce violence, whatever the reasons for those problems and that violence, can be thoughtfully approached and confronted.
We'll take it, yeah. So let's move on to the second one of those questions, the question of what matters, if you like. And it's quite interesting for people who grew up religious and then moved away from religion, which many of my guests have done, because in a way, some of them almost had to rebuild their ethics because, you know, they didn't have the religious stuff and now they've got to work it out. Growing up with atheistic parents, how did you first engage with the ideas of ethics, you know, right and wrong and good and bad? And how have you come to think about those sort of moral foundations now, if there are such things as moral foundations or roots?
Interesting question. My mother was very committed to political action herself. So I think I was a lot exposed to the feminist movement and labor movements very early on. And so I, you know, I'm not sort of an expert on cognition and how young people learn, but I think undoubtedly being around those who were championing others, who were fighting for underdogs, I think we can be pretty confident that had an effect on me. But simultaneously, I distinctly remember learning to articulate in high school, in the Canadian context, we've been sort of grade 11 and 12, so the last couple of years of secondary school or high school, and a few things were coalescing. So I was reading about Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey and Brute Goldikas, learning about the work that women were doing to save the great apes. I saw an exceptional documentary called The Secret of Life on Earth. It was an IMAX. And it had this, I came home and I was crying because it was all about environmental damage. It was about possibility as well, but it was a really significant experience for me intellectually and emotionally to learn about this planet. At the same time, I was beginning to piece together ideas of individualism and collectivism. That was how I articulated it, sort of age 16, 17, was that you can be selfish or you can care about others. And it was, you know, being filtered through some fiction, you know, some Margaret Atwood and, you know, Ursula Le Guin and just, you know, even some science fiction to thinking about the future, and was really grappling with these. But that's how I articulated it, was you can think only about yourself or you can think about others. And I was very clear distinguishing between being independent and being individualistic. Because as a young woman, I wanted to be independent and I wanted to know that I was going to have a good career and be able to take care of myself. And simultaneously, that was different from being individualistic, which is I understood as selfish. So it came in a fairly organic way, was then refined in university. I was deeply interested in gorillas. I was many years before this extraordinary advancement in human animal studies that we now see and young people now enjoy. They can take courses like the one I offer on animal welfare and sustainability leadership. They can take animals and law and policy with me and with professors around the world in these sorts of ways, looking at animals and multi-species relations through a social sciences and humanities. At that time, if you liked animals, you had to go through science. And I thought there was value in science, but it wasn't how I saw the world. So, for example, I would do research on bonobos, you know, another the great apes, and they discovered an article, a journal article on female bonding. And I distinctly remember trekking across campus to go to the science library. It was before journals were digitalized. You had to like turn to move the shelves to get to the journal. And there it was, the series of charts and graphs and tables with how many times the females had groomed or how many times they'd interacted or those sorts of things. And I recognized value in that approach. But I thought that their lives deserved more, that the stories of who they were, their subjectivity, I would now call it their personalities, I would have called it at the time, who they truly were, was not properly being captured in those charts and graphs. So intellectually, I understood the need for science and data and evidence, and in particular, you know, even then, feminist primatologists were pushing the scientific community to recognize not only male apes, but seeing the role of females and to question these assumptions and biases that were informing ostensibly objective scientific researchers who were themselves still social subjects. So being infused with their own culture and the patriarchal nature of our societies. So these things were combining, but it was too early. It was not possible to really study and advocate for animals through the social sciences and humanities. And so I delved more deeply into scholarship and progressive movements that were focused on people. And it was later in my career, you know, quite pragmatically, when I got tenure, and as the human animal studies community globally began to really expand and deepen the opportunities, that I was able to position myself and carve out a really unique place within that. And now, I mean, young people are in this absolutely extraordinary moment where they can be studying animals not only as scientists, they can do it as scientists if that's how they wish to do it, but simultaneously say, I believe in research, empirical evidence, rigor, and so I want to do it through the social sciences. Or I want to understand animals' narratives. I want to understand animals' stories. I want to read animal autobiographies so we can really begin to empathize and think about animals as subjects. So, you know, we're building, I think I can say it at this point, we've proposed the world's first major in animal ethics and sustainability leadership at Huron University College. It's moving its way through the approvals process. I'm, you know, hopeful that it will be officially approved. And then we will be able to offer another opportunity, this unique opportunity for students in the social sciences and humanities in organizational studies to be building from the decades of work that our colleagues have been pursuing, building from frontline work, from organizational leaders, from the fields of practice, building their own skills, not only their knowledge, but also their skills. So when they graduate, they can go out into the world and change the future for the planet and for all of the species with whom we share this earth. So it's a pretty incredible time, even over the course of my life, the things that I've seen, and it's an absolute honor to be able to propel this opportunity, because I see the horror, and I think we need to acknowledge the horror of the world, and need to be clear about what we've done to the planet, what we've done to each other, what we've done to animals. But along with horror, hope coexists. And I can simultaneously recognize that horror while feeling profoundly hopeful.
Well, provisional congratulations on the new master's. That sounds brilliant. And I agree. I mean, I'm very much a sort of amateur sitting outside these spaces, but it does feel like there's a whole new world of opportunity opening up for people who want to follow an academic path or even an activist path that just did not exist, I guess, when you were starting out. And to draw you back to, I guess, the ethical motivations, maybe even your mother's ethical motivations and then yours, there was clearly about, you know, fighting for the underdog and trying to do what's right. And as you said, a sort of a sense of collective and helping others. Do you think that came from a sort of empathic or compassionate concern for the experiences of others? Or was it more about fairness or justice or inequity? Or was it all of the above?
Yeah, both. I think the intellectual fodder and frameworks were there, but it was about the experience and the connection. At the very core, I think what propels me most is that I recognize that animals are someone. So that is their sentientism, and that they can think and feel. And I recognize and I see them, and I see that they can think and feel. And so I empathize with what they're experiencing, whether it's one, whether it's 10, whether it's a bird or a fish or a chicken or an elephant. I see them And I recognize that they're there and I don't want them to feel pain and I don't want them to suffer.
Thank you. Yeah, because they have a perspective, they have interests, they have needs. And to my mind, that's almost the essence of morality. I sort of tautologically define it that way, is morality is about whether and how we have concern for others. And those others are others because they have a perspective and they value things, even in the minimal sense. They value their own experience, their own suffering, their own flourishing, their own lives. And almost tautologically, that's what morality has to be, isn't it? I don't know. But people approach it in different ways. And I had some fascinating conversations with a couple of people recently who were very focused on justice. But it's almost as a technical issue of fairness that they intellectually feel very strongly, but they lack an empathic connection even with the victims of oppression. It's more of a technical thing about justice, which I find interesting, and that can lead people astray sometimes. I think, again, it's healthy to have that a rational approach to it, but also an empathic connection with the others, you know, that motivates their morality.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I mean, I've come across individuals like that, especially in law enforcement and social services, with expressions of animal cruelty, or what we call the human-animal violence link, which recognizes that animal abuse can occur after or alongside the abuse of people. It's not simply consecutive, it can be concurrent, and animals can be used as pawns and proxies. People's love for their animals can be weaponized. Abusers will use that love to try to get people to stay or to come back or to behave in particular sorts of ways. And it's a particularly emotionally difficult space within which to explore animals' pain and people's pain. And so that more technocratic idea of justice I see among cruelty investigators, prosecutors, law enforcement officers who are seeing that more often. And, you know, we know from some of the literature on work as a calling, emotional labor, which is how we perform emotions at work, these bodies of thought, we know that people in different difficult occupations develop particular coping strategies. So I think that what you've identified is that some people, that's how they begin, and they come at this issue in the first place from a little bit more of a technological or sort of intellectual commitment to justice. I think simultaneously, what I've seen is that can be the result of the difficulties of pain, of human-animal pain.
A coping strategy to
exactly
disconnect
exactly.
In some
way. You focus on what can be done, how can I do this, where is the opening? In part, you're trying to do your best for the victims and or survivors, because not all victims survive, but also trying to manage yourself. And you know, that's a central thing throughout Defending Animals, the new book, is the difficulty of the work on the front lines, that it is simultaneously inspiring and meaningful for people, but it is difficult.
Super hard. And you've already answered brilliantly the second part of this question, which is the who matters question, because many people would agree that, you know, empathy and compassion and justice are important, but many people stop with the human in-group. We know the negativisms you mentioned that can relate to, but many humans will also stop with humans. So part of the story I'm really interested in here is that journey of coming to care about non-human animals and other non-human sentient beings. And you talked about your early childhood experiences with animals. You mentioned that may have been, you know, a starting point there, then your fascination with gorillas and the sort of academic interest. And I'm interested in the path you've taken, because for most humans, they already go beyond anthropocentrism to some degree, right? They will have experiences with companion animals as a child and will care deeply about those companion animals as sentient beings, as persons, you know, as beings that warrant rights, that, you know, it would be wrong to harm them. But then they stop with the companion animals. There's also, in the academic space, it seems like many, many people who have an intellectual fascination and a rich and deep and powerful curiosity with non-human animals, such as they want to study them, they find them fascinating, but they don't make the ethical connection. Or if they do, they make the ethical connection with that select group of animals they're studying, but not others. So I'm interested in the journey you've gone through that, because I think you've feel like you've carried it much further than that. And the blockers are, you know, obviously social norms, particularly the question of animals that are farmed for food is deeply emotive and deeply resonant, and that's a really difficult one to break through. So why do you think you didn't either get stuck in the sort of companion animal space or the let's investigate wild animals because it's fascinating to watch gorillas thing? How did you go beyond that, and was that tough?
You've really encapsulated some of the key frustrations of my life and my career. I think there's good potential for, maybe great potential for progressives to include animals in their webs of compassion. But as you rightly point out, sometimes that stops at particular sorts of animals. I've had progressive colleagues say, you know, I accept that the chicken is a commodity, even while, you know, spending their career combating the idea of human labor as a commodity. I've talked to people about suffering of calves in veal crates, you know, being largely immobilized for very short lives of suffering before they're killed prematurely. And they have said, you know, point blank to me, you know, that just doesn't move me. It's an extremely frustrating, challenging dynamic that you've identified. The question of why I didn't stop, I don't know the answer to that. I can think of, I mean, I became a vegetarian at age 3.
Wow.
At the daycare, they brought out a chicken carcass, and I made the connection between chicken being chickens. And apparently I was inconsolable. I came home and I was crying, and it happened again when a fish was brought out. So I think, like many kids, that was not a unique experience to me. I immediately felt that connection to animals. We know children are taught a range of very contradictory ideas where they're reading happy stories about pigs, you know, Charlotte's Web, etc., and then being fed pigs. And some kids are able to sort through that and push back, or they may come back to it later in life. But because I became a vegetarian at age 3, farmed animals were always within my web of concern in that sort of way.
And how did you make that stick? Because I think you're right. It's remarkably common, although largely unreported, that children, I mean, I don't know, I think 3 is pretty unusual, but certainly children, when they first have that experience, when they realize the thing in the nugget came from a being. But it's so rare in current social context that children are able to have the influence or are given the latitude to even take that choice. How did that happen with your parents and the school and your own will to carry it through, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I mean, my mother was largely supportive, even though it was in an era when accessing sort of vegetarian resources was a lot more difficult than it is now. It was just something that continued. I think I continued to think I love animals, therefore I don't eat animals. I think it was articulated at that kind of...
It's that simple.
Very, exactly. Very explicit sort of basic moral level. I think now it's a lot easier for children to sustain it because there's community, because there are educators, because there can be family members, because there can be resources that they can access online as well. I think it's a lot easier for children, and that's hopeful. While simultaneously, I think the institutions like schools, universities, colleges have a central role to play in their own purchasing decisions to facilitate that ability. So, for example, Western University, of which my college is affiliated, is moving towards, I believe it's 60% plant-based food in all of its dining halls and residences by 2024.
Yeah, it's a big step.
Really rapid, and they've gotten educated, and it's a plant-forward diet that is good for the planet, good for people's health, and of course, good for animals. So to me, these larger institutions that make these decisions play a particularly significant role because of their power, as their larger purchasing power. So you know, I think the individual journeys still matter and are crucial. The decisions we make every single day, multiple decisions we make every single day, matter in really powerful ways. At the same time, these larger decisions, these organizational decisions, the decisions of leaders of organizations or leaders that are responding to those within them pushing, whether it's their students or their employees, pushing for more progressive change, that's an absolutely crucial battleground too.
Yeah. And it's fascinating. I share that frustration because in a sense, if I'm talking to someone who in intrahuman ethics is a sort of Andrew Tate style, might makes right, you know, patriarchy is a good thing, violence is glorious, compassion is weakness. At least they're being consistent when it comes to non-human animals, right? I think it's despicable and disgusting, but at least they're consistent. Whereas with someone who has a more, you know, progressive, positive maybe humanistic, intrahuman ethic, and resists oppression, resists needless violence, you know, stands for solidarity, has compassion, universal compassion for all humans, but then explicitly can't bring themselves to recognize the resonance of those issues and those opportunities beyond the human species, I find it deeply bizarre. And again, a lot of it comes back to the social norms. And as you said, there are people who are quite clear about that because they said, well, you know, it's just about humans and that's where I draw the line. So you can tell me a story about a dairy cow, but I don't see that as a form of oppression. And they explicitly just exclude those beings from the relevant sort of moral consideration. I think what's probably more common is that people want to pretend that they can care and still exploit at the same time. So with those people, they say, oh, you know, the situation of that veal calf, or yes, you know, I've just learned about what happens to the male chicks in their production, or, you know, whatever it might be, or the treatment of fishes. We'll say, you know, those are morally bad things and I wish they didn't happen, but they'll still find some fascinating epistemic roots and ethical roots to justify some form of continued, you know, basically doing nothing. So the epistemic stuff is fascinating. So the ethical stuff is a bit more like what you described, where it's just saying, look, I, you know, in a sense, I just don't care, or I don't care enough. But the epistemic stuff is fascinating because you then have this strange relationship between an industry trying to tell the world that animal agriculture and fishing is humane and sustainable, even though the word humane means being treated with kindness and compassion. And then you have a world of consumers who are desperate to be convinced that these things are true. So it's a really interesting sort of, I think it's almost the perfect crucible of human psychology and sociology as you look at people working these things through.
I nearly did my doctoral research on how people develop their critical consciousness. I was really interested in what makes some people care and others not. Now I ended up going in a different direction, but it continues to be an absolutely fascinating and important question. So, I mean, because I became a vegetarian so early, I didn't do a lot of research into farm animals. I couldn't have told you a lot of things about veal calves for much of my life because I simply didn't know. And so I think there can be an advantage of coming to these issues a little bit later in life and coming through an intellectual lens as well, because then you have the full facts. So it was when I saw an incredible exhibit. It no longer exists, unfortunately, I don't think in person. It might still exist online in Los Angeles called Uncooped. And it was about the lives of chickens. And so that's when I learned more about the egg industry, for example. There were images, there were art. It was this sort of cultural history. And I filled in gaps in my knowledge and was very affected. I read a lot of chicken stories that were biographies, and I was crying, and it was very, very powerful for me. And that was combined with an academic article that someone shared, sorry, actually not an academic article, a media article that someone shared online about dairy cows. And I felt somewhat embarrassed that I didn't know all of these things, because I just thought I was doing good for animals by not eating animals. I didn't understand eggs. I didn't understand dairy. And then I saw an extraordinarily powerful image by Joanne MacArthur of We Animals. She's a, you know, global leading.
Another previous guest.
Wonderful. Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I was very lucky to talk to her.
Of a calf who was to become a veal calf in a wheelbarrow, you know, mere hours after he was born, about to be wheeled away from his mother. And there was something in the image, and her photos are so powerful, and the animal photojournalists around the world at work are capturing pain that is difficult to fathom. And did this combination of learning and feeling and thinking simultaneously made me then reject these industries as well and see that was a missing piece of my concern. So, instead of retreating or regressing, I actually advanced the more that I learned and thought I need to expand. And the language I now use is a web of solidarity. So I include animals in my web of solidarity. And I think that's a particularly powerful term. I wrote a book about the promise of interspecies solidarity a few years ago, and it continues to drive me. Defending animals is itself a powerful expression of solidarity with animals and with people on the front lines working to save them. What I find so powerful and mobilizing about solidarity is that it's rooted in empathy, not pity per se. I mean, pity and sympathy can be part of it, but it's rooted in empathy. So it's recognizing and legitimizing the experiences of others and feeling them, even if they're not your own. while simultaneously not requiring sameness. So your struggle may be different than mine, but I support you and yours. And that to me is crucial if you're seeking to work across species, is that animals don't need to be like us, or we don't need to be like them for us to know that they matter. And solidarity is a feeling, but it can't remain internalized. It too is a fusion of reason and emotion, which invites and challenges us to act, to do something. So solidarity cannot remain internalized. Solidarity necessitates connection and movement, and ideally change.
Yeah, I love that. And again, it's a positive stance, right? It's about, as you say, you know, a feeling and a connection and a reality and a recognition of the reality of the other. You know, you're not imposing your view. It's about how they are and how they feel and what they value. But just as importantly, as you say, that imperative to act is not just a sit here and think about stuff. It's, you know, do something about it. It's powerful.
Absolutely. And it's not intended to be a one-size-fits-all blueprint that's sort of imposed on every time and place. It's an invitation for people in different contexts and situations to question business as usual and to take animals' interests seriously. And then to try to develop the best possible pathways forward. So one extension of it that I have argued is that the world of work needs to be taken particularly seriously. The large majority of harm to animals is done in spaces of work, is done for economic reasons. You know, I think it's difficult to overstate the depth and breadth of the physical, psychological, and intergenerational pain that people cause to animals. And so much of that is in workplaces. And so they're a really crucial space of struggle and possibility. So there's a really important role for critiquing the sorts of practices and economic patterns that are damaging to animals. That's central. But simultaneously, we want to be finding those solutions. We want to be finding those alternatives. And so I've proposed the concept of humane jobs, building from the idea of green jobs and the idea that we were told for so long the environment and good jobs cannot coexist. And of course they can, and of course they must. The idea is of humane jobs is inviting us to think about how can we create more humane jobs. So work that is good for both people and animals. That's succinctly what humane jobs are, to give us a new lens and a new way of thinking and promoting positive alternatives, in particular for people. So we can be improving positive areas of work, like many of those considered in defending animals, people on the front lines who are defending animals, caring for animals, often for very low pay, without any kind of workplace benefits in very difficult circumstances. The second piece is, how do we create more humane jobs to replace harmful industries? Because it's predominantly poor people from all countries of the world who are trapped in the most violent workplaces like slaughterhouses. So we want them closed, but we simultaneously need to have solidarity with those people who want a right to a just and safe livelihood. And so I think as we're talking about transitions, just transitions in the context of the climate emergency, as we must, I hope we can simultaneously be integrating a humane jobs transition strategy and lens, a way of thinking within that, so that as we're looking at opportunities, we're keeping the animals front of mind while simultaneously keeping human workers in our hearts as well.
Yeah, thank you. I guess to wrap up this sort of what matters and who matters section, this is one of the fascinating questions is, okay, what next? Because I think you can come to a sort of sentiocentric compassion where every being has the capacity to experience anything matters, you know, essentially animals and human animals and maybe some other things as well at some point, but animals is a good shorthand at the moment. But what are the implications? Now, quite a few of my guests will say, if we have a sentiocentric compassion, we now, you know, if we're going to care about non-human animals, the track record of humanity is so bleak and so awful, both in terms of farming, experimentation and testing, but also our interventions in the wild, that the best thing we should do as a result of that sentiocentric compassion is essentially to just disconnect completely. So yes, we should do a just transition to end animal agriculture and animal testing and so on, we should do that. But then we should withdraw and disconnect and just not engage with non-human animals at all, because the sense is that humans are so dangerous and even our positive intents can sometimes be quite insidious. The idea of, you know, animal labor, for example, wouldn't that just slip back into exploitation, that we should just draw a line? So your work on, you know, humane jobs and the idea of animal labor challenges that to some degree. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to say about how would you push back on that sort of challenge, where if someone says, look, are you just making excuses for a new form of slightly less egregious exploitation by considering any form of animal labor? Shouldn't we just disconnect?
Well, I mean, we're going to need about 24 hours more on this podcast for me to delve into that topic properly. But let me try to give a pithy answer. I'm not a huge proponent of animals doing work for us. I think in some cases, animals can ethically do certain kinds of work for and with us if very particular conditions are met that we would need to talk about in another discussion. So now, relationships and work are not synonyms. Work and suffering are not synonyms either. I will say that work unto itself is not any one thing. It's not inherently damaging. But we'll leave the issue of work aside. The very idea of, do we need to end human animal relationships? Of course, there are many animals who deserve the right to be left alone, or the right to engage in their own forms of care work for their own babies, their own self-sustaining subsistence work in the wild, with as little human interaction as possible. However, we are on this planet. We have created structures, roads, dams, extremely tall buildings. We are here already. So we are going to be affecting them. And so I think there is a place for us providing emergency and responsive care to individual wild animals who are harmed. I think that's a reasonable thing for us to provide. And I actually think the public sector could be playing a role for not only the animals' well-being, but for public safety and public health reasons. The bigger question of, do we need to sort of end all human relationship? I think that's a defeatist claim. I think it's a totalizing claim. It denies the nuance and complexity of so many human-animal relationships. To me, it's simply not rooted in evidence. There are so many examples of positive, genuinely reciprocal and respectful human-animal relationships that exist. Simultaneously, I am a progressive. I believe we can progress and that there is great opportunity for us to be learning, putting our values and ideas into practice. And trying to cultivate true multi-species communities. Now, I also start from a place of imperfection. I accept imperfection. I'm not a purist. I want to see us doing the best that we can. And I think that when we set up overly high standards, it's very defeatist. It can be very paralyzing and immobilizing for people if you just sort of give in and to this idea that all humans are going to be bad and abusive at all times. I mean, that, again, not rooted in evidence and not helpful as a political strategy or or a political position. So I want us to continue to work to encourage people to pursue what you would probably call a sentiocentric set of values as much as possible. I think all of these efforts are crucial. At the same time, I want to flag some developments in the economy that are going to move in a positive direction, whether people's ethics advance or not. And here I'm talking about the expansion of the plant-based foods. I'm talking about investments in lab-grown meat and dairy so that people who want to be consuming meat and dairy can be doing so in ways that cause almost no violence to animals. These strategies are extremely important. They're part of what I call the business of animal protection, which is a different way of looking at this, which is we're replacing harm, we're creating new humane jobs, we're making investments in the business world that are changing the products that people consume, from fashion to cosmetics to food and furniture. So this is a really significant time in terms of possibility. And of course, a key focus of this discussion are our people's values and ethics, epistemologies, their ontologies, all of these big words. But on a day-to-day basis, people eat and drink and make purchases. And these huge changes that are taking place in the economy because of decisions of investors and business leaders, and in certain countries and in certain places, governments are fertilizing the terrain, and more governments should be. It's going to be possible. I'm quite bullish on this. I fundamentally believe, and a lot of analysts have done the same, that the food system is going to be dramatically restructured in the next 20 to 30 years. Most predictions are a significant decrease in meat consumption from dead animals being replaced by plant-based alternatives and lab-grown alternatives. We want to recognize these, and that there are certain changes and certain developments in the world that actually don't require people to be as moral or ethical, to be as compassionate and full of solidarity as we might want and hope they could be.
I agree, right? Because there are some really obvious win-win-wins that are out there today, and we'll see more and more in the future, where there isn't even a difficult decision to make. And some of my guests worry that if we follow that sort of consumerist approach of just making things, you know, better products, fast, cheap, easy, and available, that we'll do some sort of ethical bypass where, you know, people will never face up to these issues, and who knows what horror we might go on to create in the future. But I have a slightly more optimistic cast, which I think as people shift away from products, even if they don't do so for an ethical reason, they'll be freed up from their complicity in these systems, in these harmful systems. And they'll be freed up, I think, to go back to the sort of childlike compassion that I think most people share for non-human animals. And actually, it would enable us to do that sort of ethical upgrade, even if it's through a sort of bypassed approach of, you know, fast, cheap, easy products, whatever it might be. So I agree with you that those are important aspects. And this is, I guess this is, that's framed beautifully, this final question of how do we make a better world? Because, you know, in a way, that's part of your big picture answer. There's this idea of solidarity and potentially interspecies solidarity. There's a hope about the potential for humanity's role in that interspecies solidarity. It's not just a sort of bleak, humans are evil, so we need to disconnect thing. And there's these systemic ideas, and even in the capitalist market structure, there's changes that are coming through already, which should help at least mitigate some of the horrors we're carrying out at the moment. So that helps with some of the big picture view about how we might make a better world. But I did want to give you a chance to talk about defending animals, because in a sense, the people that you're writing about there are, you know, on the front line of trying to make this type of interspecies solidarity come into being in a variety of different ways. So I don't know if you just want to sort of lay out the story of the intent behind the book and the range of different types of defense that you came across and the types of different people you came across through the book.
Absolutely. Well, and just to finish that previous thread, I think there's good intention in the argument that, you know, we want to make people develop their character and grow morally and ethically. That is the ideal goal, and that if we're taking any shortcuts to it by addressing the end product, there is sort of a shortcoming there. I would flip it and say, if we take the shortcuts, animals' lives are being saved, and if that's ultimately the goal, that needs to be kept front of mind. And is if we simply wait for people to achieve a higher standard of ethical compassion and sentiocentrism, as you argue, if we simply sit and wait for that to happen, or are working for that to happen, but it's taking a long time, while simultaneously not addressing harm that's being caused right here and now through these opportunities, through these economic channels, then we're actually doing a disservice to animals. And I think that we need to keep them front of mind, and we need to keep them in our hearts at all times.
That's a powerful point for me, because again, it's about trying to, always imperfectly, trying to, with integrity and genuinely, understand their perspective. You know, what would they want? What are in their interests? And I think that leads you both to this, you know, looking to pull all the levers, and if there are better products, then let's do it. But it also, I think, runs through your view of the interspecies solidarity stuff, because sometimes when there is a real purity agenda or a skepticism about humanity and our ability to intervene, that actually is more about what's going on in the mind of the person than it is a genuine empathy for the non-human animals we're trying to help. And that's a really important check on ourselves, I think, because it's quite easy to get into the purity thing or wanting people to do the right things for the right reasons. But if you're a victim of these systems, you just want the suffering and the death to stop, right? you're not so worried about the motivation of the humans that might be driving these processes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We want to make sure that our good intentions of complicating, of recognizing that, oh, humans are in fact multi-species bodies because we're full of microbes and bacteria at all times, or no, this is a shortcut. We need people to be deepening their ethical commitments. We need to have this sorted out ethically, purposed perfectly before we proceed. I think those are less than helpful routes to follow. And precisely as you've said, for those who are suffering within these individualized or corporatized systems of violence, they need us to act to minimize and ideally eliminate their suffering as quickly as possible, and to keep them at the center. And that is beautiful segue to this beautiful book, Defending Animals, Finding Hope on the Front Lines of Animal Protection. There is a quote from Dr. Jane Goodall on the front, the person who has done more for animals than anybody else on this planet. She sent it from the Amazon rainforest, not warehouse.
Yeah.
You know, as one
although
does.
The book is available from Amazon.
It is. Yes, you can purchase it wherever books are sold. Thank you very much for that, Jamie. 89 years old and still advocating for animals. What an extraordinary life she has led. What an extraordinary inspiration that she is. But she's just one of many stories contained in this book. It takes readers across the landscapes of animal protection, in communities, in courtrooms, and in boardrooms, where people are differently working depending on their circumstances, depending on the animals in question, depending on the organization in which they work, to try to express care. And often we are taking victims out of the stream after they've been pushed in. We're getting better at that. We're getting better at treating victims, especially individual victims, with care and dignity downstream. But there are also people working upstream to try to stop problems before they start, to try to get at the root causes of interpersonal violence, of economic violence. There are those working across the stream trying to transcend divisions, different ways of seeing the world to make the best possible change and to protect as many animals and in turn people as possible. Regardless of where, whether we're looking in New York City or Edmonton, Alberta, or across the countries of Central Africa, whether we're talking about cats or chickens or mountain gorillas, what becomes clear is that the well-being of people and animals is fundamentally interconnected. So that's the well-being of the people on the front lines doing the work, and they deserve our respect and support and good working conditions and appropriate workloads. Whether it's people who are being abused in homes simultaneously alongside animals, the multi-species nature of abuse is one we need to recognize. These dynamics are particularly clear in some of the poorest countries in the world, where people are being engaged and recognized not as enemies of conservation or animals, but rather as leaders and champions. And we need to recognize that, you know, poor Black people around the world, and especially in a continent like Africa, are literally giving their lives, are being killed in defense of some of the world's most endangered species. So wherever this is taking place, questions of poverty, questions of violence, questions of justice, they're all intertwined and entangled. And you see that in order to express animals, support solidarity with animals, you're simultaneously expressing solidarity with other people. So it is a book of hope. It is a book of possibility. I hope that wherever people are on their educational or career journey, that it gives them food for thought, food for action, and most of all, inspiration.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sure it will. And one of the things I find it fascinating is when you think about, you know, the concept of defending animals, I think many people will immediately jump to the idea of people who are doing that in a very care-based, immediate way, whether it's, you know, animal rescue or whether it's running a sanctuary, you know, people who are there face-to-face with the animals trying to help them. But it's very clear from your work and the book that there are so many different ways of defending animals. As you say, some of them are systemic, some of them are upstream, some of them are pulling institutional levers. You know, there are so many different ways of doing it. And I think that's one of the things that gives me hope, is the sheer diversity of different levers that people are pulling on all at once. You've touched on this a few times already, but some people think about non-human animal ethics as its own distinct space. It does have its own particular challenges, but many people are keen to focus on it as a separate thing because they're very nervous about linking it to intrahuman ethics. What's your sense of how we should best approach that, and how much value is there in recognizing that there are common themes, whether it's social dominance or interpersonal relations or patriarchal issues, or, you know, how much commonality do you think there is across the intrahuman ethics and the intraspecies ethics space?
A significant amount of commonality. People are the problems, but people are also the solutions. And loving animals, defending animals, acting in solidarity with animals sometimes means foregrounding their interests, their voices. They have a lot to say. They may not speak English or Spanish, but French or any languages that are verbal in the way that we do, but they have a lot to say. And so we need to listen to them and we need to take them seriously and recognize that they matter. You know, you asked a question earlier about, you know, who matters. I spend a lot of time pointing out a problem in the media, which is that animals are identified as it or that. Even when the sex of the animal is known, it's talking about a female kangaroo lifts its baby. No, she lifted her baby. So you know, who matters are the animals. They are someone, but we are all interconnected. And our suffering is intertwined, and so are the possibilities of our joy and our mutual flourishing. So, you know, I wrote this book, but the story of animal protection is ongoing, and we are all authors every day.
Yeah, we can write the story as we see fit. And I think that's one of the things that I find, I mean, I'm so lucky in this series of conversations, because I think the backdrop when you engage seriously in the animal topic is on the one hand, it's freeing and it's a privilege and it's a joy to sort of open your eyes to this space and see it clearly, and then to at least boycott the obviously harmful systems that our society thinks are normal. So that in a sense is enormously positive and freeing. But the other side of the trade is a recognition of, as you mentioned before, the sheer scale and intensity of the horror is almost mind-blowing. And psychologically, that's quite difficult for people to deal with. It can lead people into some quite, you know, dark places personally, but also in their philosophy too. And one of the things in this series of conversations, and I suspect you found this through writing the book, was tapping into that hope as you talk to and learn from people who are dedicating their lives to that genuine interspecies solidarity. You know, there's a real chance here for us to radically switch the role humanity has played with respect to sentient kind and do something deeply, radically different. And it's sort of there on a plate for us if we just decide to do it. How has writing the book left you feeling in terms of pessimism, optimism, our chance of really moving towards a vision of interspecies solidarity? Yeah. How does the balance play out for you now?
I think I could probably distill that down to a very concise response. And in many ways, maybe that's actually the sort of the concluding or overarching or underlying, depending on how you visualize thought, the dimension of how I approach all of these issues, which is a commitment to solidarity and a stubborn commitment to hope.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Well, that's a wonderful way to wrap up. Is there anything else you'd like to add into the conversation? I think we've answered what's real, who matters, and how to make a better world. So that's pretty good going for one conversation.
Well, I'd like to thank you for the work that you are doing and that all of your listeners and viewers are doing in their own lives as they navigate this difficult but crucially important terrain and look for spaces of possibility. So I want to thank you for the body of your work and the breadth of your commitment, but simultaneously for the opportunity to engage with you today. It's a particular pleasure to be interacting with a fellow hand talker. It doesn't always happen, but it is an absolute delight. And I feel the solidarity with you for so many reasons.
We can reach out across Zoom and wave our hands. Thank you. Well, it's been such a pleasure. What's the best way of people following you, reading the book, keeping in touch with your other writing? And I know you're still hanging out there on Twitter for the moment. So,
yeah, Twitter/X is at Dr. Kendra Coulter. Instagram, I'm at Huron University College at Western University. You can contact me by email. Hopefully you'll be hearing more about a brand new major in animal ethics and sustainability leadership that we'll be able to offer soon and invite students from around the world who are ready to join us in this challenge to create possibility, to create hope. And Beautiful Defending Animals is available wherever books are sold.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you again so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Kendra. Please stay in touch. It's been great to have you as a guest on sentientism. And I hope I can count you as a celebrity sentientist. So.
Wonderful.
Right. Take care. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?